is Over the Garden Gate, a program brought to you by the University of California Cooperative Extension Master Gardener Program of Tuolumne County. The mission of the UCCE Master Gardeners is to provide research-based gardening information to the public. If you would like to contact our Master Gardener Program, please call our hotline, which is area code 209-533-5912. The hotline is not manned full-time, but we do pick up our messages and we will get back to you within the week.
My name is Jordan Lowry and I'm the farmer at Dan Becker Family Farms. We grow vegetables, we grow small fruits, we grow mushrooms as well, and today we're here to talk to you about fungi. We'll do a little bit of talking. We'll talk about a few different categories of things, and then I think because it's such a broad topic and there's so many things to know, we'll switch over to Q&A and then let that lead us in the right direction, which we need to be. So maybe I guess I should start about how we start growing mushrooms at the farm. I guess it all starts off with, I used to be a grain farmer. Well, I kind of am still. We grow heirloom grains. That means we grow wheats and corns and barleys and rye and things like that. And we had this field at the farm, and it was, I don't know, maybe about the size of this room. And someone came to me and said, why would you plant that in grain when you could plant something else and make a bunch of money? And I said, well, we like eating grain, and it's good for the land and so on and so on, and we're just trying to preserve and extend heirloom varieties. And the conversation ended up to the point where, what else could you do with this stuff? You get the grain out of it, sure, you get a couple hundred pounds of grain, and then from there, what would you do with the rest of it? And well, I said, you can make compost, and you could use it for animal bedding, and you can do all this stuff. And then I said, you could grow mushrooms on it too. And they said, I would love to see that. So we got this straw and we gathered it up and we did one of our low-tech pasteurization methods, which uses limestone. We pasteurized this straw, we inoculated it, and under the house in this very, very crappy fruiting room, we grew a bunch of mushrooms. And it turns out they were really good. And it turns out everyone else liked them, so that snowballed into the next phase, which was let's grow mushrooms. From there, we were growing oyster mushrooms at that time. We upgraded from under the house into a shipping container, which was semi-climate controlled. We grew hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pounds of mushrooms in the first small container. And then from there, we moved on to the next container, which was a 40-footer. And we grew thousands of pounds of mushrooms in there. And now we've moved out of there since again, and we are now at an underground facility downtown where we grow tens of thousands of pounds of mushrooms. We grow many different varieties now as well. We don't grow on straw anymore because we couldn't grow enough straw to keep up with the demand.
Wow.
So now we grow oyster mushrooms, many different kinds. We grow yellow oysters, pink oysters, gray oysters, blue oysters, pearl oysters, elm oysters, king oysters. We grow lion's mane, we grow chestnut mushrooms, and we grow a few others as well. So as you can see, we've slowly expanded into being somewhat of the mushroom growers in town. And we'll talk a little bit about edible mushrooms. We'll also talk about the different kinds of mushrooms that grow in the forest. We'll talk about mushrooms that grow on your farm, ones that you can grow in your garden, ones that improve your garden. Then there's the different molds and yeasts and as well, and we can talk about that as well. So if you want to classify mushrooms, you can classify them into basically three broad categories. There's mushrooms and toadstools and such, there's yeasts, and then there's molds. All three of them have beneficial properties and traits as well as negative traits. We concentrate mostly on a few specific kinds of mushrooms, which are saprophytic mushrooms. They decompose raw organic matter. So they decompose the straw into mushrooms. They decompose wood chips. They decompose animal manures and things like that. Then there's also what we call mycorrhizal fungi. These are fungi that need a relationship with a tree or a plant. They form an interwoven relationship with the roots of the plant. They can extend the root system up to 50 times or more. Going deeper into the soil, going farther into the soil, looking for water, looking for nutrients, looking for minerals. These kind of mushrooms are your morels, your chanterelles, your porcinis, and things like that. These ones grow in the forest. They're not fully cultivatable. They are cultivatable with extreme knowledge, skill, and equipment. In China, they grow morels. In China, they grow boletes and things like that. We don't necessarily have the technology, knowledge, or skill to do it in this country yet. So they're a little farther ahead of us, but they've also been growing mushrooms for thousands and thousands of years compared to hundreds of years. So we're going back. We have the three different kinds of mushrooms. We have saprophytic, mycorrhizal, and then there's parasitic as well. An example of parasitic mushroom is the honey mushroom, which is also an edible mushroom, but it's also the largest organism in the world. So it's in Oregon, and it covers about 20,000 acres, and it's a mushroom that covers the whole area. So this one organism is about one cell wall thick, and is the largest organism on the planet. You've done genetic testing over here, maybe a mile or two that way, genetic testing, mile or two that way, genetic testing, and it's always the same organism. So it just shows you how big these organisms can get, how far their mycelium ranges. So now we can talk a little bit about the base anatomy of mushrooms. So we have in the mushrooms that we eat and the mushrooms that we grow and the mushrooms that we use in the garden, there's a few different parts. So we have the main part, which is the mycelium. This is like the roots of the organism. This is the actual organism itself. Then we have the fruiting body. Think of this kind of like the apple to the tree, except for this apple tree is completely underground in the form of the mycelium. And then there's the spores, which is somewhat like a seed. In the mushrooms growing that we do, we always use clones. Very rarely do we use spores, because spores are like seeds. They produce variable offspring. We're always looking for the same traits over and over. We want the same growth rates. We want the same patterns of growth. We want the same type of fruit, we want the same color of fruit, we want the same densities and things like that, the flavors. So those are all things. So we're in the mushroom business, we're always using clonal propagation. There are people who are using spores and such to develop new varieties of mushrooms. At the moment, a lot of the buzz in creating new varieties is in cordyceps. How many people have ever heard of cordyceps before? Cordyceps is a fungus that attacks insects. So they will find the insect. Most commonly people have seen like that Planet Earth thing where the ant crawls up to the top and the little spike comes out the top of the ant's head. That's a form of cordyceps. There's thousands and thousands and thousands of varieties of cordyceps out in the world. We collect and cultivate Cordyceps militaris, which is a very medicinal mushroom. It's bright orange, and lately people have been doing a lot of breeding with that as far as spores. So those are the different parts of the mushroom and the different ways that they reproduce. We can take the mycelium and manipulate them, propagate them in many different ways. At the farm, we use agar, so we do petri dish work to keep our cultures very pure. But as far as a homeowner and a gardener and so on, you can play with just the chunks of the mushrooms. An easy example would be, if you go home, you get a mushroom, you take the butt, you chop it off, and then you throw it into a jar. And if you like coffee, you pour your dried used coffee grounds on the pile of, or the little butt of mushrooms, and it'll actually start colonizing the coffee grounds. And every day you can dump your coffee grounds on there, and it'll keep eating it and keep eating it. And then eventually your jar will get full and you can stop, and it'll produce more mushrooms. Mm-hmm. From there you can take that up and grind it up and go spread it into your garden. And there are different kinds of mushrooms which are actually quite beneficial to your garden. There's one called King Strepharia rugosa annulata, which is what we call the garden giant. They can get about maybe about that big. That's a nice size one. They can improve your garden productivity up to 400%, increasing the nutrient uptakes, the phytochemicals that help with pests and disease resistance and things like that. It's an easy mushroom to get going in your garden. You usually do like kind of a lasagna method. So you'll lay down some cardboard, and then you'll sprinkle some of what we call spawn, and then which is just little chunks of mycelium grown on grain or sawdust. And then you can layer some more cardboard and then some wood chips and some more spawn. And then just keep it moist. If you start in the fall, by spring you have a nice King Strepharia patch.
Wow.
And you can start planting your vegetables in there. Berries do very well in there. Things that are more perennial based, like blueberries and raspberries and blackberries and currants and things like that do excellent with that. So this way you're using the mushrooms to create an environment which is giving the higher quality properties and nutrients for the plants that you're trying to grow, which in turn give you more nutrient dense food, which means more nutritious berries. So there's many different ways we can use mushrooms. People have been making mushroom leather. You can take waste corn stalks and leaves and twigs and things like that, grind it into a really fine powder. You can fill a mold, and there's a mushroom called Ganoderma lucidum, which is the reishi mushroom. And they'll colonize this in about 7 to 10 days. Then they'll dry it out, and they have a unique process to turn that into a leather. So you can get a product that's stronger than kangaroo leather in 7 to 10 days instead of what would be 18, 20 months for beef leather. So it's sustainable leather. There's people making insulation. There's people doing micro-remediation, which means cleaning up soils, contaminated soils. How many people have heard of Paul Stamets, the master of mushrooms? He entered into this contest. They had 5 piles of soil, and the goal was to remediate this pile so that something would grow in it, so that it was no longer toxic. And they had motor oil in there, so they just put used motor oil over these piles of sand. One of the things, the other companies would put their powders, and the other company would put their liquid chemicals, and Paul Stamets just put oyster mushroom mycelium. And the other piles sat there still oily. And Paul's pile kind of started to do something. It started to like turn white with the mycelium. This pile started to go and go forth, and it started, basically, there was no more oil in it. The mycelium ate the hydrocarbons in the oil. The piles kept going. There was still 2 more, 3 more stinky piles over there full of oil, and Paul's pile started to grow plants. Started to grow flowers because this mushroom mycelium bioremediated these dirty piles of soil with hydrocarbons of oils and gasolines and things like that, and started remediating the soil to the point where things could actually start growing in it and living in it. And he won a really good prize for that. It was some sort of competition, but it just shows how well mushrooms are at cleaning the environment and making use of the materials that fall to the ground. Without mushrooms, without fungi, we would basically be probably a mile deep in dead twigs and leaves and things like that. So we need them to recycle that nutrients in the forest, nutrients in the leaf fall, nutrients from the logs. There's only very, very few organisms in the world that can decompose lignins. Bacteria cannot, so logs and things like that need to be either broken down by actinomycetes or fungi. So they're always playing this important role in the world. One of the things we like to do in permaculture is we like to set the organisms and develop them as an element. This way you can learn about them a little bit more. So we always have an element, let's just say fungi, and we always have needs and inputs and results. So we know that mushrooms breathe oxygen just like we do. So when we have the mushroom's mycelium running, as we call it, in our mushroom grow bags, we want the CO2 to be very, very high, because mushrooms run, as we call it, much better at high CO2 parts per million, but they fruit at much lower, like they'll run at about 20 or 30,000 parts per million, and they want to be fruiting at about 400 to 450, which is about outside air temperature. So if you go into the fruiting room at the farm, there's lots of fresh air coming in because we're always trying to refresh the air. Just like right now, we're all breathing out CO2 and there's no plants in here to refresh it. We have fresh air moving back and forth into the room to give us clean air to breathe. So mushrooms need fresh air. Mushrooms need a substrate to grow on. In nature, this is logs. It's the forest litter. it's cow patties, it's decomposing organic matter. So they need somewhere to grow, they need food, they need water to keep hydrated. So without high levels of hydration, the mushrooms would just dry out. In the forest, you'll often find dried out mushrooms that didn't quite make it because it wasn't humid enough. So they're always fruiting in the right season. So we're always trying to find wild mushrooms and things like that from about October until May. From there, the sporadic summer rains might give us some morels and things like that up in the forest if we get a little bit of rain. So now they need substrate, they need oxygen, they need water, and they need a cool environment. Most mushrooms don't do anything in the higher ranges of temperatures. Most of the mushrooms we grow require to be somewhere around 60 degrees. That's about their sweet happy spot. Of course, there's always exceptions to the rules. In Asia, they grow paddy straw mushrooms, which like it about 90. We grow yellow oysters, which like it about 85. Pink oysters like it about 90 degrees. So there are tropical mushrooms that grow during other seasons. Most of the mushrooms we grow are cool weather mushrooms. So the lion's mane, they like it about 50 degrees. The oysters like it about 65. The chestnuts like it about 55, 60. Shiitakes like it about 50 degrees. So that way, we're trying to create a controlled environment to grow these mushrooms. Now, I want to say it's not hard to grow a mushroom. It's actually quite easy to grow mushrooms. It's quite difficult to grow lots of mushrooms regularly on schedule. That is the difference of growing mushrooms at home, which is easy, and we'll do a little talking about that, and growing mushrooms on scale commercially. So there are a few mushrooms, one we already talked about, the King's Jafaria. There's also the almond agaricus. This is more, it's related to the button mushrooms you would get in the grocery store, portobellos, criminis, and so on. This is a good mushroom to grow in your garden. It actually loves growing on compost and straw mulch. So if you mulch your tomatoes, if you mulch your peppers, if you mulch your garden, this is an excellent mushroom to grow, and they'll actually fruit all summer long. So you can get a couple hundred pounds of mushrooms just from a small garden and help decompose the straw much faster. So that's called the almond agaricus. That's an excellent, excellent mushroom. The King's Jafaria is more of a fall and winter garden mushroom, but it also helps doing its mycelium thing in the summer, helping decompose the mulch in your garden, providing nutrients for your vegetables. One of the cool things you can do with the King's Jafaria mushrooms when they get this big is use it to feed your chickens. So you take this giant 30-pound mushroom and you hang it in a sack above your chicken yard, and here comes the flies and the larvae and stuff, and the larvae fall out of the mushrooms onto the ground and free chicken food. So in other parts of the world, the King's Jafaria is actually used for animal fodder in the form of feeding chickens. They'll hang them over their ponds to feed fish, things like that. So there's all these different uses after just eating the mushroom that we're always trying to help people get into. So now that we have the parasitic mushrooms, the mycorrhizal mushrooms, and the saprophytic mushrooms, those are the three main types of mushrooms that most people are involved with. The other kinds of mushrooms and fungi, actually, are the molds and the yeasts. One of the ones that most people are probably really familiar with as far as consuming something, soy sauce. Soy sauce is made from a fungus. Soy sauce is made from Aspergillus oryzae. It also makes miso, soy sauce, tempeh, things like that. This is all made from fungi. It's not a fruiting mushroom. It doesn't not make a mushroom. It's more of like a mold. And it colonizes what they do called rice, and they make koji, and then they also use it to make sake. So there's different uses and different fungi out there all over the world. There are a few yeasts that we use as well. Obviously, we make beer with yeast, so in some ways, beer is a fungal food. Not too many other yeasts in the world that we're using. Most of what people are used to is just cultivated fungi. So now we can talk a little bit about the process of how we go from, let's say, a wild mushroom to a mushroom that you would buy at the store, or a mushroom that you would buy at the farmer's market, or so on. Let's say I was out in the forest and it's spring and we come across an oyster mushroom. One of the things we can do is collect this mushroom and take a tissue sample just in between the cells, so we want to get inside the mushroom, and then we'll drop that on a little sterile piece of agar, which is inside a petri dish. From there, it'll start growing on the agar, and then we'll take a little piece of that and put it on some sterilized grain. This could be wheat, this could be sorghum, this could be rye, this could be oats, it could be any whole grain, really. It'll colonize that, and then that's what we call the master spawn. So from there, the reason we're putting it on grain is because each one of those grains becomes a separate inoculation point. So once it's colonized this little jar of grain, which might have a couple thousand little grains in it, you shake it up, and now you have a couple thousand inoculation points. So now we can take that master spawn and put that inside another jar, or we'll take that one jar and expand it into 10. So now we have 10 jars of spawn, which we can take and sterilize our substrate, which could be the straw. We could use straw, we could use sawdust, we could use corn husks, we could use hemp fibers, we could use basically any of those waste materials that agriculture would produce. So now we have all these jars of spawn. We can take that and sterilize or pasteurize our substrate and inoculate that. From there, it's going to take a little bit of time to colonize that. We're going to put that into what we call our incubation room. The incubation room is a little bit warm. It's very high CO2, so that the mycelium will run much faster. Some mushrooms grow a lot faster than others. Oyster mushrooms run about 2-3 weeks. If you do it really, really well, you can get it done in a week and a half. Chestnut mushrooms take about 2 months. Maitake mushrooms take about 5 months. So really just depends on the variety at this point, how long it's going to be in the incubation phase. From there, it goes to a cooler room. So now we're going from warm to cool. So now there's a temperature shock. And most mushrooms, when they get lower temperature and higher humidity, they trigger to fruit. So now we have these separate room, which we have our fruiting room, and we're putting the blocks in there. From there, in about 24 hours, you'll start to see these little tiny bumps where you put the slit inside the bag, because now you're also introducing oxygen. So we introduced oxygen, a lower temperature, and a higher humidity. These are the triggers for the mushrooms to start growing from the mycelium. Now we have these little bumps, and we call them the primordia. It just looks like little brain, little bumpy brain looking thing. And it'll go from about size of my pinky nail to about the size of my fist in about 24 hours.
Wow.
And then from about the size of my fist to about a 2 or 3 pound mushroom cluster in between another 24 and 36 hours.
Wow.
And then from there, it's ready to harvest. So that was the complete path of finding a wild mushroom, cloning it, expanding it again, running it into the running incubation phase, putting it into the fruiting room, harvesting the mushroom. And we can do that with all kinds of different wild mushrooms that are more of a saprophytic. So we can't necessarily do that with morels and porcinis and things like that. We can collect the mycelium. And we've been doing some interesting things where we grew morel mycelium on wheat, and then we dried it, and then we powdered it, and then we made pasta with it. So you ended up with this morel mycelium infused pasta flour.
Nice.
It was excellent. But we have yet to figure out how to get a mushroom out of it.
Right.
But that's okay. It is possible. It's just a matter of knowledge, skill, and equipment, resources, trial and error, things like that. I guess since everyone was so interested in the truffles, we'll talk a little bit about the truffles. So the truffles are a mycorrhizal species. They need a living relationship with the tree. So commercially, you can go buy inoculated trees. You can go buy inoculated oaks. You can go buy inoculated hazelnuts. You can go buy inoculated chestnuts. And these are inoculated with the white truffles, the black truffles, et cetera, et cetera. It's not 100% foolproof. So I had a friend in New Zealand. His neighbor planted 10 acres of inoculated hazelnuts. they told her that it was going to be 10 years before she got her first truffle. She waited 12. Nothing. She sold the property.
No.
The lady that bought it had a dog. And they, she goes around and finds truffles. So it was 13 years, not 10. That being said, we live in an area with lots and lots of wild fungus. So it is quite difficult to get them going here. In the next couple years, we will have inoculated chestnut trees for people to get if they're interested. That'll probably be 3 or 4 years, and then another 10, 15 years before you potentially get something. But at least you'll get chestnuts out of it, and chestnuts are delicious. Chestnut wood also grows good mushrooms, so you can continually get a coppice and grow mushrooms on logs. So we grow mushrooms inside these sterile bags, and we're basically creating our own little log. You can do what they call outdoor propagation and outdoor cultivation, where you're inoculating logs. This is more of a seasonal product. The quality is a lot higher, so log-grown mushrooms are usually more expensive and harder to find because they're higher quality. The only problem is their season is from October until May, and that is the complete opposite of our market season. So we grow indoors on fabricated logs, basically. And this comprises of sawdust and sometimes a supplement like wheat bran for a little extra nitrogen for an extra boost. This gives a little bit better yield and things like that. So those are the ways that we grow mushrooms. We grow a few logs, we grow mostly indoors, and then we also grow a bunch in the garden as well. That gives us a diversity of products. We have about 12 mushrooms throughout the growing season, depending on the season. From there, you can, some people come and get the spent blocks and add them to their gardens for the mycelial benefit. Sometimes they get mushrooms out of it. We've had people take home blocks and bags and bury them in their garden, and here comes a picture of this big old oyster mushroom grown outside under a big old tomato plant, things like that. So it is possible to get the mushrooms to continue on into your garden. They, of course, they're always giving you the benefit of decomposing nutrients and things like that. Taking all, so the question was the coffee grounds and the mushrooms. Do you want to dry out the coffee grounds? And the answer is no. You want them to be fresh out of the coffee press. So they're basically going in sterilized. The making coffee is the process that sterilizes the substrate, which is the coffee grounds. And then every day you add. And it grow, oyster mushrooms grow so fast that they'll colonize that in a matter of hours.
Wow. Amazing.
Do you need to use the mushrooms from your farm, or are you talking about store-bought? Like
could
market?
Be store-bought. Fresher is better.
Fresher.
Because the mycelium isn't as damaged. Oysters is the best thing to do that with, though, because they grow so fast. I wouldn't try it with, like, that is another way we use fungus in the farm. We're not just cultivating funguses and mushrooms that we eat. We're cultivating funguses and mushrooms that help grow the things that we eat as well, because everything in permaculture is connected, and we're always trying to create less stagnant loops. We're always trying to connect things so that this helps that, which helps this, which helps that, which helps this. Because in some ways, permaculture isn't the tree or the apple or the water. It's getting the water to the tree to feed the chicken. In some ways, using the water and the fungus to grow that tree to feed the animal ourselves as well. So we're always using fungus in many, many, many different ways. Like I said, we can do the materials building, like the leather and the insulation and the fabrics and the clothes and the shoes and things like that that some people are doing. There's people working on it as far as medicine and things like that. There's people growing it for food. There's so many different aspects to fungus that really it's an uncharted world. And there's so many different opportunities out there just to improve the general functions of our lives. And that's fungus.
Thank you so much, George. Awesome. Very nice. Need a reminder of what